tonight on Arena. Transforming the Cúirch International Festival of Literature into a digital offering, and Danny Smith, the spoken word artist, offering his own candidates for president. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. The 2020 calendar for arts festivals has emptied out for reasons we know only too well, but one festival has managed to mutate online. The Cúirch International Festival of Literature in Galway is now billing itself as a digital literature festival. And from this Thursday, 23rd of April, until Saturday the 25th, it's live streaming 11 events over 3 days on the Cúirch YouTube channel. Authors appearing include Anne Enright, Kevin Barry and Eimear McBride. And Kevin Barry and the Cúirch Festival Director, Sacha de Boyle, join me now on the line from the West. Sacha, I mean, Galway has always had a great reputation for its festival festivals, and as much as anything, it's about the buzz that's around the city at festival time, the streets, the cafes, the pubs, the restaurants, everywhere's busy at the time. Very different type of atmosphere, I would think, that you'll be going for this year.
Yes, it's definitely a bit of a change. This is my first festival as director, and I have to say it's not what I expected in terms of the, you know, as you mentioned, the atmosphere. Galway has never been quieter, but hopefully the living rooms of Galway will be absolutely hopping this weekend.
Tell me exactly how you're going to go about bringing the festival into our living rooms.
So we're working with Atlantic Audio, who are our audio and technical providers for the festival as it normally is. And we are creating live stream events, bringing together our authors into kind of a virtual chat room, as it were. It looks a little bit like Zoom, but it's going to be branded up differently. And anyone who wants to come along can simply go online and treat it like a regular festival. Browse our programme, book tickets to an event if they'd like to go, and then on the day they'll get sent a link to tune in via our YouTube channel and or also our SoundCloud if they are listening into one of our podcasts.
All right, well, I'll come back to you a little bit on more of the nuts and bolts of that a little bit later on, but let me go to Kevin Barry at this point. Your first ever virtual appearance at a festival, I'm guessing, Kevin, or maybe not.
It is actually, Sean, yeah. So it's we'll give it a go, you know. I mean, as you were saying, Cúirch is an especially magical festival, really, because of the setting. As you know, springtime in Galway is always a great buzz to sense the place coming to life again. And this year it's going to be different, but it's if we can manage to replicate even a little bit of the magic digitally, it's worth trying for anyway, you know.
How are you finding the whole isolation process, or the self-isolation process? How are you getting on up around? Are you actually in Sligo or Leitrim? I can never remember which county it is. You're on the borders there, aren't you?
I'm inside the Sligo line. I'm South County Sligo. I mean, it's in some ways. I mean, I live rurally, so the day-to-day texture is very different from the usual, you know. But I'm remaining cheerful. I'm showing up at the desk of a morning and trying to do a bit. It's like it's a strange time, you know. We all have a kind of a bit of a lethargy, I think. The initial paranoia has maybe eased somewhat, but it's quite hard to settle your mind on a writing project, really. I'm putting in the hours and I'm sitting there, but it's I would say production rate has fallen dramatically short compared to the usual, you know. I'd say I'm about a third or a quarter of the usual number of pages arriving out at the end of the week.
Why do you think that is? Because the presumption might be, well, there's a writer, they're used to the self-isolation idea, they're used to putting themselves into their shed or into their room or wherever it is, sitting there by themselves for long periods of time and working away on the empty screen or empty page in front of themselves. What's different about now that's reducing the production rate by so much?
Yeah, it's strange, isn't it? I think one of the things is when you're writing fiction or drama or anything like that, it's a lot of it is coming from the subconscious, you know? And I think we're all very well aware that our subconsciouses are affected by the current thing that's going on, the way we are all having these strange, mad, vivid dreams and everything, you know? So it's even if you're calm enough in the moment and rattling along, happy enough during your day, you know, it's still occupying the back of your mind, the fact that there's this big traumatic event going on that's affecting so many people in so many terrible ways. So it's I think what's very important is not to be given out to yourself if the same about the pages aren't coming out, to be kind of kind to yourself and just say, you know, as long as you're showing up and making the effort at something. You can start to wonder about, like, Jesus, there's so much going on in the world. Are they really waiting to find out what's going on in my short story, you know? But it's you put that to the back of your mind as well and just kind of plough on with it, you know?
I'll go back to Sasha then, Sasha, on some of the nuts and bolts a bit for the... Kevin mentioned there about being a little bit generous to ourselves. In fact, you're being very generous to us in one respect, in that normally if we were going to the festival, to the physical festival in a venue, we'd pay a little bit of something towards the actual event itself. But everything will be free in this digital offering.
So all the events are going to be free. It was quite important to us, I think, given that it's a new thing for us. You know, we're testing out a format that we've never used before. And so we wanted to give that to audiences in as accessible way as possible. I mean, in an ideal world, I'd love if every event was free. But of course, authors need paid and upkeep needs, you know, paid for as well. So,
although you still have to book, and you can partake in things by asking questions, but those questions must be asked ahead of time.
Yeah, we'd love to have as many questions as possible for our authors. Of course, each session will have a moderator, as it would in a regular event. But if any audience members or anyone listening would like to submit a question in advance, they can just email them to info@court.ie. And we'll be able to filter them all down and make sure they get to where they're going and get asked on the day.
I sincerely hope, Kevin Barry, that you're not going to get a glimpse of those questions beforehand, because I suppose part of the excitement of a live event is precisely that you're reacting to questions that come from the audience or even from your moderator that you're not expecting. That is what gives it its flavour.
I hereby faithfully promise that I won't look at the questions beforehand, Sean. I go at it in the usual way.
Well, I hope Sasha has taken note that you're not to be showing them. What is happening at the moment, Kevin? Because I know there is a book of short stories finished and ready to go to press, or what's the state of play there?
There is, yeah. It's my third book of stories. It's coming in, I think, the end of October. So hopefully it'll appear in something that resembles a normal world. It's called That Old Country Music. And it's basically, it's 8 years since my last collection, Dark Lies the Island. So I kind of gathered about the stories that were lying around the house and down the back of the couch and all of those places that I've written since. And I had about 18 or 19. And I selected 11 that seemed to form a set, you know, that seemed to kind of talk to each other a bit and that seemed to have kind of themes and kind of... And geography often in common. Actually, a lot of the stories in the new book are kind of set up around the Northwest now. So it's interesting to look back at a chunk of work over 8 or 9 years, and unbeknownly, you know, your work is talking to itself all the time, and you're kind of responding to previous stories you've written. So it was nice to be able to kind of what feels like a real set of stories to put them together and see them kind of fit in, you know. I guess it's a bit like musicians putting an album together, trying to find a thread, you know, that pulls the thing together and makes it a kind of a coherent whole, or so you hope.
Well, music has always been important in your stories and in your novels, in fact, but That Old Country Music suggests that you've gone a very particular route with the style of music for this collection. Would I be right in thinking that?
Well, definitely there is lots of musical references around the place in the book. There is a story called That Old Country Music. It's a new one that I just finished before Christmas. It's a story about a young lady waiting in a van in the hills of the Curlews in County Sligo while her fiancé attempts to rob the local petrol station with a claw hammer. So I'm knocking myself out here as usual. Didn't say it today, you know. So it's it was interesting. One of the things that kept propping up again and again was were these kind of references to music and to country music in particular in the stories. I am a bit of a country music fan myself, so it was nice to kind of to get that title on it.
Would you bring any of your country music heroes into the shed with you to get yourself away from isolation, or would that just stop you from writing altogether?
I do listen to music a lot when I'm working. I tend to go for stuff that doesn't have lyrics in it. So I would listen to quite a bit of classical and jazz and kind of old reggae records and stuff. The lyrics can kind of distract you, you know. But you know, no, it's important for me to kind of make a mood in the room and kind of almost kind of it helps to distract you from your own kind of train of thought in a funny kind of way and let you kind of try to work in a more natural kind of way, where you're kind of directly plugged into your own subconscious. If this doesn't sound completely pretentious and esoteric, I don't know.
Well, actually, let me plug you back into your consciousness, maybe okay. for a moment as well. In that respect, you mentioned Dark Lies, the Island, the collection. 8 years, you say it is.
It was 2012.
Yeah. There you go. Obviously, we've had the film in the meantime. How closely did you work in that, and what was that experience like to visit the stories in that respect, in that way?
It was fantastic to see see actors kind of take characters who'd appeared first in stories and to run with them, you know, and of course to transform. You know, when you write a story, you're writing it to be read as a finished object. But when you're writing a script, it's just kind of an opening salvo, really. You know, it's a kind of a blueprint you're given to actors and directors and technicians to work from. So fantastic to have people like Charlie Murphy and Pat Short and Peter Coonan and Tommy Tiernan go at the characters and see what they could do with them. It's a learning curve to write for the screen, but I really enjoyed it. And I believe we're now available on YouTube or some one of these streaming things to get the film if anyone hasn't seen it.
Right, that's Dark Lies the Island from the previous story collection. I mean, you say that you finish the stories as stories themselves, you don't even think about screen, but having had the experience with the Dark Lies the Island story and collection and then that film that came out of it, can you see, even within that old country music, the new collection, could you start to look at it in that respect yet?
Possibly, yeah. I mean, I've adapted other things for screen. There's always sort of scripts hopping onto the desk as well. It's you know, I've always felt with the short stories as well that they work well aloud. People like to hear them at readings and stuff. So it's a natural step really to think of them in terms of what actors could do with them and where they could go with them. I'll definitely stay involved in that regard as well. Hopefully, continue to write screenplays and so forth.
And the other presumption that I would have would be that, you know, given at this time of isolation, if you're saying that the rate of production is down, it's harder to concentrate, it seems intuitive to say that, well, you'll be writing short stories now as opposed to digging yourself into a novel. Is that necessarily the case? What is the work practice there?
There's always kind of a bit of a queue. It can be a bit like air traffic control with the desk is always mad stuff. One of my kind of, it's a great benefit as a writer is that I get ideas all the time, but it's a problem as well because you're always desperate to get on to the next thing, you know, and it's just an impatience to start on that new idea you've had. So it's I do have a tremendous love for the short story as a form. It's kind of my first love as a writer, and it's something I go back to again and again. I think kind of because of a congenital impatience. If a story goes well for you, it can be finished inside a couple of weeks, you know, which is compared to the long slog of a novel or a script. It's a very attractive thing if you're of a temperamentally flitty kind of nature and you want to get something finished quick. Good or bad, just to have a finished thing on the desk after a short period is kind of very, very, very beguiling for a writer, you know.
Well, obviously, Sacha de Boyle, who's also speaking to us this evening as we're talking about the new digital version of the Courage International Festival, where Kevin Barry will be. Obviously, people get a sense that Kevin's not going to have any problem with the digital medium and getting his message across. Sacha, who else will be there? What other writers are you managing to hold on to? Because obviously you had to make the event much smaller overall.
Well, that's a good question. We decided to focus in on a lot of our headline events, which lucky for us happened to be by some really brilliant Irish writers this year. So this year we've got Anne Enright, Eimear McBride, Kevin Murray, as mentioned, and he's going to be speaking to Jan Carson, who's another excellent writer of both novels and short stories. On the nonfiction front, we've got Sarah Baum, who's going to be discussing her new book, Handiwork. And she's going to be speaking alongside Sinead Leeson, who we're really delighted to be able to welcome kind of last minute to the programme, talking about her essay collection, Constellations. Mm-hmm. And I think those two books actually just will speak really, really well to audiences at this time, because they're both about kind of navigating the world around you. Sarah's particularly, as it, you know, encompasses a very, very small space. So I think it'll be a good one.
Yeah, so there are lots for people to check in on there. And as we said, all of the events are free. You can make a donation if you so wish, but there's no obligation on you to do so. And if you want to get your questions in, you have to ask them a little bit ahead of time. But I'll come back then finally to you, Kevin. Is this kind of the way forward, do you think, if we can't have the real event, and real isn't the right word to use, if we can't have the event where we're physically present, do we have to just imaginatively find new ways of doing it? And is this a good way of trying that out?
I think we have to try, yeah. I mean, to be honest, Sean, I'd normally be the last man on the planet who'd be doing anything digitally. And I try to stay away from technology as much as I can. But we have to try new ways, you know. I mean, no one knows how long this kind of stuff goes on for, how many times it's going to repeat in the future. Writers in some ways are lucky because, you know, the work you produce is going to be consumed by people in their own homes. It's so much more difficult for our actor cousins and our kind of musician friends, and to figure out how to do it. But you know, people are turning their minds to it. I think you're going to find that digital events and platforms become much more smooth. We'll start to work out the kind of kinks out of it. But you know, it, we're lucky to have it. It's great to have something to be able to sort of, you know, all the arts is, it, speak generally, it's a conversation, you know, it's an ongoing conversation, and it, anything that helps us keep the talk going is worth trying.
Well, finally then, Kevin, has your attitude to the digital world changed? I know you were never a great fan of Twitter. People are saying now, well, the people are much nicer on Twitter now, and we might have given out about FaceTime calls, but now it's, do you know, I actually would like to see that person as I speak to them rather than just be speaking into the void. Is your attitude changing?
Well, maybe a slight softening, but what I can't handle, to be honest, are all the invitations to the Zoom drinks parties. I really don't feel like I need to sit around looking at you drinking at home. You know, we could just all do that on our own. Rest assured, I'll be thinking about you, but I don't have to look at you drinking on the internet. I really don't.
Fair enough. Well, I'll cancel that invitation then for the weekend. So that's Kevin Barry. Thanks very much, Kevin. And also Sasha DeBoyle there, the artistic director of Kirch, which this year is the Digital Literature Festival, running from Thursday the 23rd through until Saturday the 25th of April. And you can find out full details on kirch.ie. A poet and spoken word artist, Danae Smith, was born into a devout Baptist family in St. Paul, Minnesota. Smith is non-binary and uses the pronoun them or they, and became one of the voices of Black Lives Matter when their poem Dear White America went viral. Danae Smith's most recent collection is called Homie, or at least that's what white people call it. Colm Keegan, who's been reading the Danae Smith collection for us, will explain all of that shortly. But let's begin with a flavour of Smith in action. This is a section from a poem called My President, where Smith chooses to name ordinary friends, family and acquaintances as their president, which chimes, of course, with the moment we are currently living through, where we have had to rethink who is important in society.
And my grandma is my president, and her cabinet is her cabinet, cause she knows to trust what the pan knows, how the skillet wins the war. And the man I saw high kicking his way down the river, he is my president. And the trans girl making songs in her closet, spinning the dark into a booming dress, she too is my president. And Shonda Rhimes is my president. And Nate Marshall is my president. And Trina is my president. And the boys outside Walgreens selling candy for a possibly fictional basketball team, they are my presidents. And the bus driver who stops after you yell, wait, only twice is my prez. And dude at the pizza spot who will give you a free slice if you are down to wait for him to finish the day's fourth prayer. He is my president. And my auntie, only a few months clean, but shit, clean. She is my president. And my neighbors who hold the door open when my arms are full of laundry is my president. And every head nod is my president, and every child singing summer with a red sweet tongue is my president, and the birds and the cooks and the single moms especially, and the weed dealers and the teachers and the meter maid who lets you slide especially, and the cab drivers who stop, and the nurses' swollen feet, and the braiders' exhausted hands, and the bartender and Beyonce and all her kids, and the rabbi and the sad girls, and the leather daddy who always stops to say good morning, and the boy who was crying on the train, and the sudden abuela who rubbed his back, and the uncle who offered him water, and the drag queen who began to hum, oh, my presidents, my presidents, my presidents, my presidents, show me to our nation. My only border is my body. I sing your names, your names, my mighty anthem.
And that was poet Danis Smith reading a section from their poem, My President. As I said, Colm Keegan has been reading the collection Homey for us. He joins me now on the line. We really can hear in that recitation and performance, because really he knows how to perform. They know how to perform their poems pretty expressively, Colm. But the influence there of the Baptist Church in the use of repetition and litany in the poems, you know, is my present, almost like a refrain. I know that's a poetic thing, but it's hard not to link it in with the Baptist background, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And you can see that, like, kind of that doubling down, that reiteration of the same word over and over again. It's like a common theme in rhetoric. You can see it, like, even in the likes of Martin Luther King are all great speech writers. But it features very strongly in a lot of slam poetry. And you can see it at work in all of Homey and Danis Smith's kind of cross, harsh and really innovative cross-examination of a select few words, like Homey is one of them, dog is the other one. And the book, interestingly, isn't actually called Homey. When you open the book, a note inside says this book was titled Homey because they don't want non-black people to say, you know, the real title of the book out loud, and you can find out what that word is for yourself if you want. But there's a really interesting story behind the book, because struggling in the, like, Danis Smith would be for me, like, almost, you know, in my house he's a household name. I mean, they're one of the most exciting voices in poetry at the minute for me. And a lot of that came from just winning the Forward Prize and struggling in the wake of the huge impact of Don't Call Us Dead, Danis Smith's second collection. They struggled with a bit of second album syndrome, I think, you know, even though it was the third book. And looking to escape the pressure of past success and accolades, they kind of were forced to deviate, or decided that, sick of kind of struggling with the idea of profiting from black suffering and frustrated with their poetry being misinterpreted kind of as trauma porn, they worked to move away from that and took a more personal turn, starting with a deep investigation of the N-word itself, actually. And that became a prism, or that became a device through which friendship could be really, like, kind of deeply explored. And that deep investigation became the catalyst for the whole new collection. So there's kind of still a strong political thread in there, but it's incredibly personal. It's a really, it's a very vulnerable work.
As you said, Colm, Homey is the title that is presented to you on the inside, and it's explained to you what the actual title of the book is. I think we need to give a warning before we hear this next poem, because that word, that title, the N-word, is used. You've given us the context, so let's listen to Danis Smith perform.
This one isn't about language, but about who the language holds. Those niggas who say my name like it's good news, who let me know my blood is speckled sapphire. I am in love with purple gums, the yellow stain of front teeth, the bit of plaque unbrushed away revealed when my niggas laugh. Oh, loves, I know God is, for I have seen you throw your cackle in the air and watch the clouds turn heavy bronze. I have seen tears well in the corner of your eyes when you are overcome with joy, and that little wet is all the sea I need to live. We are alive, and amen. Some of us are dead, but they are alive within us. Amen. Heaven be your blunted breath, your chapped lips in sharp shade, your ashy elbows and lotion prayers. I need no church but my nigga's arms. I need no savior but their love. Oh, sweet God, if you be my nigga, never take my niggas from me, lest I be a black and yokeless shell, yet lest I be a tabernacle at the bottom of the sea, lest I be whittled down to not a nigga but an N-word. One letter to say a thing about shame. Keep me away from that kind of hell.
Dannis Smith there with the opening section, the opening verse, in fact, of their poem, Homie. I'm not going to give it the other title because he wants white people to say Homie. That's how they want the poem and the collection to be referred to. Colm Keegan has been reading Homie for us and he's joining me on the line this evening. Again, the repetition and the references to religion, very strong, perhaps even stronger in that poem than in the previous one that we heard. Does religion play an important part, do you think, in Danny Smith's output column?
Yeah, I would say so. And not just like, and you know, you can even see in the president's poem, this kind of subversion, like the destruction of all hierarchies and the create, like there's no mention of Obama or Trump in presidents. It's all like, you know, it's a level playing field in this world. And it's the world of like the familial, it's the world of local, it's the world of home. And when we return, so when they return to this, to the home field, to home turf of language, of African-American English. This is the language that's been used in the book is familiar and probably arguably quite ordinary to Danny Smith. But what we get is this, like the Forward Prize said, you know, that Danny Smith shows like an astonishing formal and emotional range and a mastery in metrical and musical language. And they said themselves that a poem is a poem is a damn poem. And a good poem, in my mind, has a life both on the page and in the air. And there's this beautiful kind of re-examination of familiar language. But it's like the more specific they become, it's like just there's a discovery of new fertile soil, like right under your nose, you know. So even in terms of the book kind of focuses a lot on home in all of its contexts, from a sense of just home being a community. Like, so Danny Smith would have came out and found a lot of support in the LGBT community, and a lot of his friends or their friends would be in the same context. But also to go back to this coming of age and how hard it is to grow up in that context. And Jump is worth looking at. The poem is worth looking at in that context. A brutal, beautifully constructed poem that explores masculinity, coming out and coming of age, and the intersection kind of between intimacy and violence. And you know, there's killer lines in it, like the fists that broke my ribs also wanted me to live. I praise each one true God for each foot that was not a sharp anything. I had always wanted eight on me, but not like that. Each hand laid upon me like a rude and starving prayer. So there's the closer it gets to home, the harder it is. And that in a way is kind of the paradox of the book, because it's selling itself as a departure from the territory that Danny Smith became famous for, which is the political territory, the milieu of like Black Lives Matter. And inevitably, as you talk about the African-American experience, it's impossible even to talk about the relationship that they have with their friends. It's impossible that the political doesn't rear its head, you know.
And also, I suppose there's a very important aspect here when you talk about that innovation in terms of structure and form. I think it's often presumed that that's not an important thing for spoken word poets. But Danny Smith seems to have managed to really, you know, straddle the world of the poem and the page and the world of the spoken poem. How do you think they've managed to do that?
Well, it's like, I just believe it's kind of the cutting edge of what poetry is sort of capturing the spoken word and keeping it alive on the page. In some ways, it's like, you know, sort of trying to domesticate smoke. And you can see in Jumped, it sounds brilliant. There's a lovely meter too, but it's also fascinating in its form. And maybe we could, I actually tweeted a link to the poem, so this was kind of joy just looking at the structure of it, because there's so much to it there, especially the shape of the stanza in Jumped that represents the circle of attackers around Danny Smith as a teenager, to understand the text as a diagram. And you can see parallels with people like all the way back to Amir Baraka or Gwendolyn Brooks, great African-American poets. Or even like Walt Whitman, or, you know, even someone like Dylan Thomas, who would have, you know, really enjoyed the shape of a poem. So clearly we're clearly looking at someone who's structurally innovative, and it might be surprising to people who think of spoken word poets as that, but I think this is the definitive successful spoken word artist now who can, you know, the work is getting published in by the Poetry Foundation, and it's in the New Yorker, and then it's gone viral through Button Poetry. And Smith is an alchemist, and the book is full of that kind of sprawling examples of formal skin and innovation. There's a poem called How Many of Us Have Them, where Smith's actually invented a whole new form, paying tribute to this like amazing traditional African-American spoken word game where two combatants insult each other. And you can see parallels with hip-hop and battle rap, and even back to people like Dolemite, who used to have these great put-downs. And they created this kind of 12-stanza poem, each stanza increasing in length, starting with one line and ending with 12. And the poem actually functions as a key or a template for how a spoken word poem builds, or how good rhetoric actually functions, you know, starting off tight and hemmed in and growing exponentially and organically into this like huge effusive burst of language, like a giant kind of tree bursting into bloom before your eyes, you know. And I think of like people like in the Irish context even, or Abby Oliveira, the words kind of spiral out from her, you know, and you can see the thing come into full bloom at the end. So yeah, he's a there's a great example of that kind of work right across the world right now. Some people could dismiss spoken word as saying it's not technically brilliant, but the likes of Dana Smith kind of you know, proves to be the exception to that kind of assumption, you know.
Well, Smith has made it public that they are HIV positive, and in Homey they write about that in poems like Undetectable, which I know you use quite a bit as a poem for workshops, but also in the poem Sometimes I Wish I Felt the Side Effects, and in this they talk about living with HIV.
Sometimes I wish I felt the side effects, but there is no proof but proof, no mark but the good news. There is no bad news yet. Again, I wish I knew the nausea, its thick yell in the morning, pregnant proof that in you, life swells. I know I am not a mother, but I know what it is to nurse a thing you want to kill and can't. You learn to love it. Yes, I love my sweet virus. It is my proof of life, my toxic angel, wasted utopia, what makes my blood my blood. I get it now, how beauty so loved her warden. If you stare at fangs long enough, even fangs pink with your own blood look soft.
That is Dannis Smith there, reading from their poem Sometimes I Wish I Felt the Side Effects. And it was Colm Keegan before that who was speaking to us about the latest collection from Dannis Smith, that collection called Homey to Most of Us. It's published by Chatto. Mount Alaska are an ambient electronic duo whose latest album, Wave Atlas Season 1, offers track titles that transport us to the fjord and to polar and lunar landscapes. Mount Alaska are Steve Shannon and Killian McDonald, who are both with me right now. They're such evocative names. The track titles are so evocative. I mean, you feel yourself wanting to go to some kind of polar or lunar landscape just by saying the titles themselves. This was a payback from your wife, or is Sinead Gleeson, Steve, the track titles?
Yeah, well, I kind of make a lot of music to film, and we were interested in the idea of making an album together that was like a soundtrack, but we hadn't got a TV series or a film to make a soundtrack to, so we decided to invent one. So we kind of created this kind of landscape, and we made music to it using the equipment that we have available to us, and then we got to the end and realised that we needed something more exciting for titles, so I kind of pull back a favour from my wife.
Yeah, because Sinead had recently produced Constellations, her book, and you had written music for some of the essays and stories within that.
Yes, we had played a few shows together where I'd kind of done a musical interpretation of some of the pieces she'd written, which we really enjoyed. We played in a couple of art centres around the country and the Hugh Lane Gallery and places like that. But yeah, we just created something together. So it was really nice to be able to kind of give the songs back to her and ask her to kind of think of some titles for her to kind of tells a story of the songs.
But it's interesting. I'm just interested, Killian, in what the starting point was then. You had no visuals whatsoever. Did you have a brief? Did you come up with kind of concept yourselves between the two of you? What did you do?
I mean, it's really interesting because it is a blank canvas. So when there's no pictures there, there's no scripts, there's no nothing. You really can go and do what you want, depending on what the label agrees to. But we were in this like kind of unique position where the idea, the concept came to us. We're always writing music, quiet, loud, slow, fast, whatever. The concept came to us because we did have the opportunity to do a record a little bit different with a label that had approached us. So because of the work that Steve does, because of, I suppose, me being a little bit jealous of that and kind of wanting a piece of that, I was like, hey, why don't we do something like a soundtrack to a TV show or a movie? Because Mantalaska, up to that point, are known as kind of like an up-tempo dance music for indie kids, like cerebral, nice. But there are many more sides to us.
Now, when you say you were jealous of what Steve was doing, are you talking about his production work or
the day job?
Work?
You know, jealous of the day job, maybe a little bit.
I would guess, Steve, that for you, somebody being jealous of the day job, you might. Does that surprise you that Killian has that envy?
I don't think he does. Really, I think he was just joking. I think Killian's got a great day job.
What day job does Killian have?
Killian works in the Irish Times for his sins.
Ah, right, okay.
But no, I kind of started out, I built a little studio of my own, about 15 years ago now. I was kind of working with recording bands, and that's what I was really interested in at that time, was kind of recording and producing records with people. But I kind of slowly grew away from that and kind of grew more into making soundtracks for films and television. And I find that really engaging, much more engaging than the work I was doing previously. Because it's lovely. You get to make music all day long, which makes me very happy. And sometimes I even work in my pajamas, you know. But, you know, I just get to make music all day, which I really love. Sometimes I make music for people I never even get to meet because I'm working remotely. Yeah. And I really enjoy that process.
It's but we also get to put like loads of this emotional, evocative music together. And at the end of the day, it packs a bit of a punch. So kind of then going along and trying to name that is a different story altogether. Mm. But like our partners, Sinead and Patrice, are very close to this project, very close to the music. So, you know, they probably would have an understanding of
the ideas,
you know. Yeah. And, you know, it was quite interesting to also collaborate, I suppose, and work with someone else on this. And also, I suppose we're kind of control freaks. So actually kind of handing something over while terrifying, it was kind of exciting as well to see what would come back from it.
Well, let's listen to one of the titles then, Subterranean Heart. So you presented Sinead with this piece of music. She came back with the title.
Yeah. The entire album.
The entire album
and said nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, she thought that the album reminder of kind of vast, open, cavernous spaces or depths of the ocean. And so, because a lot of the tracks are really, really emotive. They're very large and swelling and repetitive and, you know, kind of ululating.
Sad.
Yeah, sad. Which is kind of a joke between us, like, you know, make it sad.
Make it sad.
Well, let's have a listen to Subterranean Heart. Subterranean Heart there from Mount Alaska, Steve Shannon and Killian McDonald. So sadness was one of the emotions clearly that you wanted to get in there, but it does have, a sound engineer was saying to us as we were listening there, it has this epic quality to it. It has a big feel to it.
Yeah, I suppose we like going for the emotional jugular, I think.
Yeah, we do. Yeah, we don't waste our time. Well, Killian and I have known each other for a long time, and before we even decided to release music, we just got together to make music. We just kind of sit there and have a couple of beers, and I have a collection of old synthesizers, and Killian buys lots of synthesizers as well, and we just plug it all in, and we'd make sound with it, and it always just kind of ended up going that way. It's kind of based on repetition. Like some of the really old synthesizers I have a kind of a hold function. So you can just pick a couple of notes and it just holds them, and you can use the settings on the synthesizer to slowly make it larger and more epic. And I think it was always going to go that way.
And is, am I right in thinking that several of the tracks, you, in some ways, you're paying homage to some of the great stars of ambient music?
I suppose some of our favorite composers, for sure. There's no harm in honoring your influences.
Like, give us a few examples.
Yeah, so I mean, like we spoke, we've spoken in interviews about like the impact that people like Johan Johansson has had on us, Max Richter, Oliver Arnolds, Ryan, Rival Consoles, Delia Derbyshire, Wendy Carlos, people like this. These are people that go back to like our teenage years, like watching movies like Tron. These are people that are soundtracking stuff like Black Mirror now.
Max Richter was Black Mirror, wasn't he?
Yeah, yeah, and Rival Consoles. Did Rival Consoles do one as well?
He did an episode, yeah.
Yeah, Rival Consoles and Max Richter. And like, I suppose that's about as relevant as, is it even TV? It's Netflix now, I suppose, streaming. So we're really drawn to A, the music they make. Some of them use a lot of like analog synths and modular synthesis, which we'd really be attracted to. The reference points we were always talking about and listening to collectively. We listen to a lot of music together and we share and swap a lot of music. Yeah. It's a big thing for us. So I don't see any problem in signposting that.
Back to the Land, My Love, the title of that track. And that's the opening piece of music from Wave Atlas Season 1, which is the new album from Mount Alaska. The piece you heard in the middle of the interview was The Subterranean Heart, Mount Alaska, the duet comprising Killian McDonald and Stephen Shannon. And the album Wave Atlas Season 1 is available now on Spotify. In Britain, stars of stage and screen, the arts and music are working together to bring one of the great poems of the Romantic period to life. Samuel Taylor Coleridge's The Rime of the Ancient Mariner is an epic tale of seafaring adventure, fear and despair. It's also a kind of warning across the ages from the 18th century to now around the importance of the natural world and the role of the human race in either its protection or its ruin. The Ancient Mariner Big Read is commissioned by the Arts Institute at the University of Plymouth. The 150-verse poem has been divided into 40 readings, with each reader recording a sequence of three or four verses to be broadcast over the internet day by day. Once complete, it will be available to listen to as one symphonic offering with a specially designed soundscape by Jay O'Byrne. The readers featured include Tilda Swinton, Hilary Mantel, Lem Sissé, Alan Bennett, Iggy Pop and Marianne Faithfull. But it's Jeremy Irons who gets the proceedings off to a powerful start.
It is an ancient mariner, and he stoppeth one of three. By thy long grey beard and glittering eye, now wherefore stopp'st thou me? The bridegroom's doors are opened wide, and I'm next of kin. The guests have met, the feast is set. Mayst hear the merry din? He holds him with his skinny hand. There was a ship, quoth he. Hold off, unhand me, greybeard loon. Eftsoons his hand dropped he. He holds him with his glittering eye. The wedding guest stood still and listens like a 3 years child. The mariner hath his will. The wedding guest sat on a stone. He cannot choose but hear. And thus spake on that ancient man, the bright-eyed mariner.
What an atmospheric start that is to the Big Read of Samuel Taylor Coleridge's Rime of the Ancient Mariner. Jeremy Irons, the voice that you heard. You can listen to the other readings as they drop over the month on ancientmarinerbigread.com. Una, by Alice Lyons is a novel about, among other things, grief, art, language and place. Set principally in suburban New Jersey and rural Ireland, the novel charts the protagonist's progress as poet and visual artist while discovering her own sense of self. Stylistically, the novel sometimes reads as verse, but it has a unique feature: the almost complete absence of the letter O. And Alice Lyons joins me now to explain that and other things. Absence of the letter O, except in the protagonist's name, Una, which of course has two O's, Alice. But looking at Una's life, we'll get this bit out of the way. First of all, you know, living in suburban New Jersey, her mother dies young, she moves to rural Ireland. These echo events in your own life pretty much as they are. What's the relationship here between biography and what we're reading about in the life of Una?
Hi, Sean. Thanks. Thanks for having me on. Yeah, there's definite alignment between my own experience and the experience of Una, my protagonist, but it's a work of fiction, and I'd say it isn't autobiography, but there is definitely personal aspects. I very much wanted to write the book and draw on my own personal experience, but really as a way of writing from a place of sincerity. I think that was something that was very important to me about the book. So it's more in that realm than any kind of events or autobiographical incidents that line up, because there's lots in it that is made up, is fictional.
So there are lots of things that happened to Una and in her life that never happened to you, and therefore
That's
it's
right.
not that important in that respect. What about then the lack of the letter O with a character who has two O's in her name? What were you looking for there?
Well, part of writing the book was about writing about how art making and creativity are ways that a person can knit herself back together when her life has been torn apart by grief, and in the case of the situation she grows up in suburban New Jersey in the 1970s, of a community that's very focused on making money and on rampant capitalism, really just trying to acquire things. And in the process, there's a denial of death. There's actually a lot of resonances with what's happening just right now because of this virus and the way that people are being robbed of the ability to be with their loved ones in their last moments, which is a profound loss and something my heart really goes out to those people at this moment in those situations. But in the book, Una goes through an experience where she is losing her mother to cancer, but is not told that the mother is dying. And after the mother dies, Una isn't able to take part really in the rituals of the death. And so something in her goes quiet and gets frozen. And I wanted to write about a protagonist who has something that's empty inside her. And so I don't really know how it happened, but in the process of writing, the idea came to me, well, I love the name Una, and that was the name that the protagonist took, but what would happen if I took half of her away? So I just started to play. I mean, my background is in poetry, so playing with language is what I like to do. So I just started to play around with the sentences that I'd already written and taking the O out of them. That's how the writing without the O started to happen.
Well, that's lovely that it is, as you say, because she's double O-N-A, you're taking away half of her. But it's something that's echoed in some of the immigrant experience, which I was quite interested in. People who maybe moved to America in the early part of the 20th century, maybe your parents, people of that age and even older, where they dropped parts of their name because perhaps it was too difficult to pronounce it, or, you know, they just thought, oh, it'll be easier for people to spell if I drop that vowel or I drop that syllable.
Yeah.
To what extent do you think naming is very important in terms of identity?
well. You also touch on place names in America in this respect, how they've lost their Native American origins, Alice. How important is that?
Yeah, there's a whole in the book, Una is living in a community where the land that they're living on is land that in the very recent past was occupied by Native Americans. But there isn't any sense, in addition to their losing a sense of they're denying death and they're losing a sense of the rituals of death, they're also losing a sense of the history of the land that they live on. So the community people don't really know anything about who was living on the land beforehand, but their streets are named after tribes of Americans, Native Americans from out west, very kind of exotic tribe names that certainly have nothing to do with the tribes that were living on the land that they're on, but have a kind of panache and are a nice thing to have in your address, but really have no connection to the history of their place.
And of course, there's a whole debate around the place names in Ireland and the use of whether you use the Irish name or the anglicised place name. But let me talk about one other aspect of when Una comes to Ireland. The thing she notices, the new language that she has to learn, they're very talkative people, she says, but in fact, silence is the language that she has to learn.
Yes. Yeah, there's in the book a quote from Neil Belton, who was John McGahan's editor, who says that the native language of the Irish people is not Irish, it's silence. And yeah, there's this whole, this code that Una has to learn when she gets to rural Ireland about what, she has to learn to read between the lines and learn the difference between garrulousness and talkativeness and sincerity and when people are saying what they really mean and when they're actually misdirecting with their language. Yeah.
I was interested just finally in one thing. I mean, the word potato doesn't appear because you refer to it as tuber. But Una comes here during the Celtic Tiger times. You didn't need to change the name of the Celtic Tiger. But do you know what she calls the Celtic Tiger? Do you remember that?
I'm sorry, no, I don't know what you're referring to.
I will refer to it then for you. The Great Latte Shift, which I think is the best renaming of the Celtic Tiger I've heard. That's Alice Lyons there speaking to me about her book, Una, which is published by Lilliput Press, but we'll have to leave it there for this evening. We'll be back with you tomorrow night. In the meantime, let me tell you that Paula Shields and Liam Murphy were the researchers this evening. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound. And tonight's programme produced by Keshi.